obviously.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Committee on Judiciary. It's Monday, April 11th. We have three bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. I have Senator Morris here, so we're going to start off with Senate Bill 961. I'll open up a public hearing on 961.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 961 comes from Senator Morris, voids construction agreements provisions that require a party to the agreement to waive the right to seek indemnity, contribution, and reimbursement for damages due to the negligence of another party.
Good morning, Frank.
Good morning. Good morning. Mr. Chair, colleagues, for the record, Frank Morris, I represent the Albany-Corvallis areas in the Oregon State Senate. Thank you for giving a hearing to this bill this morning. I would like to provide briefly a background to ORS 30.140. Interestingly enough, when I was actually in the shoes of Dave Bull, president of Morse Brothers at that time, I appeared before the Senate Judiciary to amend 30.140, and the basis of that bill was the fact that owners and prime contractors were transferring by contract, requiring indemnification for their negligence, whether caused in whole or in part, to the lowest tier contractor, subcontractors. And we presented that issue. The bill passed. It was then challenged in court. It found its way to the Oregon Supreme Court. And interestingly enough, the testimony that I gave as president of Morse Brothers was cited in the Supreme Court ruling with respect to the intent of that bill. Now, Bill Taylor, I'm sure you can appreciate and colleagues can appreciate what we say as legislators with respect to intent of legislation. But the Supreme Court went through that and to the testimony of me as a layperson at that time with respect to the intent of the bill. What this bill does today is it seeks, the intent is to seek to clarify what that language means with respect to when you require by contract indemnification for your own negligence to the lowest tier party in an agreement. And what I would like to do is, I take great pleasure today to join with my former colleagues, Steve Fry, who's the Vice President of Administration of Knife River, formerly Morse Brothers, and Dave Ball, who is President of Knife River, and let them explain the background and the circumstance in which we bring this bill forward today and what we're trying to accomplish. Now, what I would like to also point out is that we have a work group that has formed. We met last week, and we want to make sure that the language, in fact, does what we intend it to do, and to bring that back for your consideration, Mr. Chair. So with that, I'd like to introduce my good friends.
Thank you, Senator. Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Dave Bull, as Senator Moore said, currently serving as president of Knife River, and Steve Fry is our regional controller over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and also our risk manager. For those of you that aren't as familiar with us, we are suppliers of construction materials, aggregates, ready-mix concrete, asphalt paving, and we have a pre-stressed concrete yard in Harrisburg. We're involved every year in hundreds of construction contracts. Sometimes we're the general contractor, sometimes we're a subcontractor, sometimes we're a material supplier, and we're here today to address our role as a subcontractor. We have seen a dramatic and recent increase in the number of clauses that have been added to construction contracts that we've been asked to sign. These are known as waivers of subrogation, waivers of immunity under workers' comp. In every case, they seek to get the subcontractor to give up some right that they already enjoy by law. As Senator Morse mentioned, we had a similar thing happen in the mid-90s. Back then, the language that started showing up were the indemnity provisions that required a subcontractor to indemnify a general contractor or project owner against all liability, even for the negligence of the owner or the general contractor. And the Oregon Congress took that matter up and passed the changes that Senator Morris was referring to. Senate Bill 961 does not introduce some new intent or some sweeping change. It's simply an attempt to rewrite and update this existing law to match some of the new contract provisions that we are seeing, whose intent is the same as the ones that we saw under the indemnity provisions. The intent is to move liability from owners and general contractors down to the lowest tier subcontractor. It's not a coincidence, I don't believe, that this has showed up at a time when work is scarce. Subcontractors are desperate, and the balance of power has shifted towards contract owners and general contractors. Steve Fry and I were recently trying to negotiate a change in similar language with a large national general contractor. We were put in touch with their risk management department back on the East Coast. We were asking to be let out of this waiver of subrogation clause. After discussions that weren't going anywhere, I asked this gentleman, would you sign your own subcontract? And his response was, absolutely not. I'd be crazy to sign that. And I asked him, well, then why do you expect us to? And he said, because we can. There's a long line of people. If you don't want to sign it, get out of line. We'll sign up the next one. The issue is not static. The number of these provisions that are showing up in contracts is increasing monthly, and it's now gone into not just owners and general contractors, but municipalities are now asking for these same waivers of subrogation and so forth. And so I would ask you to consider this bill as not new legislation, but an attempt to just continue the intent that was established with the update of this law in the mid-90s. And with this, I'll turn it over to Steve Fry, who truly is our expert in this area.
Thank you. Senator, Chair, and members of the committee, just this year, we've had $4 million. My name is Steve Fry. I am the Vice President of Administration for the Pacific Northwest at Knife River. I probably look at 600 contracts a year, and in those contracts we're seeing more and more language changes to try to shift risk from owners to primes to subs. And in doing that, they're trying to push a liability that belongs to someone else down to the lowest tier subcontractor. Since the first of the year, about $4 million worth of work, we've negotiated to the point of having to decide whether we keep jobs in our company or we refuse the work. That's a tough choice for a contractor that is suffering from about 40% unemployment right now, just in our business. So making that decision is very tough. And although the liabilities could be very large. Now, I've asked my insurers to try to insure this risk separately from us, and have been refused. They have no interest in insuring every person we might come in contact with. So the only way we do that is to take the insurance on ourselves, which drives that cost up. The point is that will drive costs up to the point where small contractors will either have a disproportionate amount of cost, which may drive them out of business, or the risk itself, by the size and cost of it, will put the small businessman out of business. So addressing this bill is very important to us, not necessarily the language, although that is very important, but really the idea and concept that every party to a construction agreement should take on their own liabilities and risks, that we don't need to shift it to simply the weakest player in a construction contract.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got two other people that are signed up for this bill, so we'll go ahead and call them up. Brian Craig, I believe, and Dee Birch. And is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 961? Gentlemen, whoever wants to start, give us your name.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee, my name is Dee Birch. Currently serve as president of the Oregon-Columbia chapter of AGC. We have about 1,000 members, a mixture of generals, subcontractors, and suppliers, and industry associates. We are in support of the concept of clarifying liability and where it lies, and that it truly lie with the person who caused the damage. We have some concerns about the language, the way that it's drafted. We are part of the work group that Senator Morse mentioned. We're very interested in working with that work group to come up with some language. We had a meeting last week to kind of start that process. I think it's important to note that the Bar Association had a meeting to look at this and looked at it fairly quickly, but they unanimously did not support the language as drafted, and they're also part of this work group. So I think that's about all I have to say. We're very interested in clarifying that. One other comment, we do have a fair amount of members who believe that 30.140 is very clear the way that it is, and that a lot of these clauses that are in these contracts are really not enforceable. But we're going to continue to be in this work group. We're going to continue to try to do anything we can to clarify this language and support the concept. It's just a matter of how it actually happens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Krieg, representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. Our members are subcontractors mostly, occasionally do the role of a general contractor. Our members saw this bill and are very interested in seeing the concept go forward. We also agreed that the language needed to be worked on. We're going to be very interested to work with the work group on this, but would encourage your support of this. Everyone should be taking care of the issues that are theirs, not taking care of someone else's. Our contractors indicate to me that it's very common at the time that they have won a bid, they're in the final bit of the contract negotiation, they're down to the last bits of paperwork, and then these documents are shoved in front of them. And this is a very sensitive issue and something you really can't say no to in this environment. So your help on this would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for either of the gentlemen? Thank you all very much for coming forward. So this is going to conclude our public hearing on Senate Bill 961. My understanding is that the work group will continue to meet, and for all those involved, realize that next Thursday, a week from this Thursday, is our cutoff date. That means we have to have anything and everything done way before then, so we make sure we get all the fiscals and everything taken care of. So if we want to try to keep this moving forward, I need you to please participate as quickly and get through the work that you need to and get it back with our staff so we can make certain we have everything ready to go. With that, thank you very much. We'll close that public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up for our next public hearing, which will be Senate Bill 376. Yep. And as we change counsel, I'll go ahead and open up that hearing on Senate Bill 376.
And thank you, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. I will be directing my comments to 376 as amended. 376 as amended by the -1 amendment would create the crime of aiding another person to commit suicide. This would be done by intentionally selling or transferring any substance or object to another person with the intent that the other person use the substance or object to commit suicide. This would be punishable as a Class C felony carrying a maximum sentence of 5 years imprisonment or a fine of $125,000. There are some exceptions carved out in the structure of Senate Bill 376-1 to avoid the application of this bill to healthcare professionals or individuals complying with the Oregon Death with Dignity Act.
All right, so thank you very much. What I have on the registration, I have three individuals that are signed up at this point. I'm going to have you come up as a panel, and then we'll see if there's anyone else. Zach Konowski, Alex Gardner, and Lisa Millett. And is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony today on the amendment 1-2376? And I think the order I'm going to ask, Zach, if you'll lead us off, Alex second, and then Lisa following.
My name is Zach Klonoski, Chairperson Brzezanski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. I appear before you today with a heavy heart and in strong support of Senate Bill 376. The last time I testified before legislative committee, I did so with my brother, Nick Klonoski, by my side. Today, the chair next to me is empty. Well, Nick's not here. On December 17, 2010, my brother Nick took his own life. The gravity of the loss to my family and I cannot be put into words, so I will not attempt to convey to you the devastation I feel every second of every day. What makes Nick's story even more troubling is the method he chose to employ to take his own life. My brother ordered what can best be described as a suicide kit, an easy-to-follow manual with all the necessary parts included except for a helium tank. However, as the suicide manual points out, a helium tank can be easily obtained from any business that offers helium tanks for blowing up balloons. The manual even goes out of its way to instruct the user to ask for a party balloon tank rather than a helium tank to avoid suspicion. With no background check on who is ordering these suicide kits, the GLAAD company is mailing these suicide kits out every day to whoever happens to stumble across their website and place an order. In a society where so many people suffer from depression and other mental health problems, this company has found their niche in the market by peddling death. This is analogous to putting a gun vending machine next to a depression clinic. It may be good business, but it cannot be allowed. The GLAAD company, so named as to avoid suspicion in case a family member happens to sign for or come across the package, made $60 off my brother's death. We cannot sit idly by and watch this group continue to make a profit by preying on vulnerable members of society. My family and I don't know if Nick would still be alive without the existence of the GLAAD company, a company that makes a profit by advocating for people to give up. But I do know that I will be haunted by that question for the rest of my life. The helium hood method of suicide is extremely effective, and as a result, people who attempt suicide employing that method rarely, if ever, survive. I cannot help but think of a close family friend who was suffering from severe depression and attempted to take his own life by driving his car into a tree. He was severely injured, but he survived. Today, less than 5 years later, he is married and has two beautiful children and is extremely happy. I doubt my friend would still be alive today had he happened to come across GLAAD's website. Now, while I had never heard of the helium hood method of suicide before I became all too familiar with it after Nick's death, this is not an isolated incident. As reported in a recent Register Guard article, the GLAAD company has estimated annual sales of $98,000, equal to the price of 1,633 kits. Very troubling and symbolic of the prevalence of the problem was the response from the police officers that first responded to the scene of Nick's death. As more officers arrived, they simply asked the first responders, "Is it the book and the kit?" Without any more explanation than that, the first responders answered, "Yep." We cannot allow this to go on. These types of organizations have been allowed to live in the shadows for far too long. I urge you to support Senate Bill 376 so no other family has to go through what my family is going through and will continue to go through. With the sale of one of these helium hood kits, the GLAAD company smashed my family into a million pieces. We are broken, and we will remain broken for the rest of our lives. Please don't allow another family to be destroyed by this shameful group. In closing, I just want to say, sorry.
All right.
In closing, I just want to say that my brother Nick was a beautiful person. Loved politics, sports, and the University of Michigan. His family and friends. He excelled academically and had political instincts far beyond his age. He fought his entire life for social justice and cared deeply about his community, state, and country. It would be a disservice to him to remember him only for the way he died and for this bill. I ask you to remember and honor him by always standing up for the vulnerable and voiceless members of society.
Those people who may not possess great financial or political power, but nonetheless are the majority of the people you represent. Thank you for allowing me to testify before you today.
All right, thank you, Zach. Alex?
Good morning, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Lane County District Attorney. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 376. Mr. Klonoski has made as compelling a presentation as I can imagine, and there's very little I can add to that except to say that we are seeing these kits with some regularity now. They are probably being used with a greater frequency than we can measure, because often when family members find their loved ones and dead having used one of these kits, they remove the evidence of the kit. It's appalling to think that there are companies out there making money this way. They're essentially peddling death and relying on people who are at a particularly low spot and relying on basically an impulse purchase to peddle death. The only request that I would add, other than general support, is that the committee consider making this a more serious crime. As a C felony, we will lack support for extradition, and since these kits are being peddled on the internet, most of the would-be defendants are out of state. So if we're to have any teeth at all, we're going to have to be able to extradite these people and have some leverage. That's all I have, unless there are questions.
All right. Thank you. Lisa?
Thank you, Senator Przonski and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Miette, and I am the section manager for the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at the Oregon Public Health Division, and we're now the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you very much. I'm here to provide information and testimony for Senate Bill 376-1 to make it illegal to sell suicide kits. Two of the programs that I oversee are suicide prevention and violent death reporting systems in the state of Oregon. Unfortunately, the story that you've heard today occurs far too often in Oregon. We have over 500 suicide deaths occur in the state each year. And each one of those deaths, a large portion of the community is impacted. One of the prevention messages that we work on getting out there is that means matter. There are some forms of means that people use to complete a suicide from which people can be saved. The type of helium kit that we're talking about with this particular bill is very effective in its use, as effective as a firearm is. Now, we would never make firearms illegal, but we always caution families with people who have a mental health problem or who are actively suicidal to remove those means from the household during a time when a person is actively suicidal. With a suicide kit such as this, a person would order it in secret and hide it, and no one in the family would even know it was available. So the intervention point that could occur within the family system is basically hidden from view, and the opportunity to intervene is very limited. We think that with all the suicide prevention activities that we're undertaking in the state, that this particular bill would really help support those efforts. And we would encourage you to pass this bill.
All right. Thank you. Excuse me. Question, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Zach, thank you so much for being here and for telling your story. I think all of us in the building knew Nick, and I assure you that he won't be remembered for something like this. But I recall all the times that he was in the building and all the work that he did and you did on the bill last session. And I attended Nick's service and still at that time was thinking, how could this have happened? And then when somebody sent me a link to the Eugene Register Guard article about the helium kit, I remember thinking, this is horrible. How could this be? So I just want to thank you for coming, and as hard as it is, telling us about this. Thanks.
You're welcome. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. First for Lisa. What is in this? I don't know anything about these kits, because I'm not That's it?
That's it.
I got a bunch of this in my shop.
Yep.
That's for our sprayer. Are there other examples other than, I mean, are there other kits available, other methods, or is this kind of the prime one?
Senator Prozanski, Senator Cruz, there are a number of, shall we call them businesses, that are helping to support people's intent to commit suicide. This one in particular, though, is peddling a method that, as you see, would be fairly easy to put together in your own shop if you knew how.
Right.
If you knew how and you knew where to go to get the the helium and how to connect it.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. So people find these on the Internet, I guess. Would you just Google suicide and that's where you get to them? Or what's the main way one would get access to this?
Senator Brzezinski, yeah, Senator Cruz. I know you have a couple of computers here. Maybe Senator Dingfelder could Google suicide kits and show you how quickly she can get to one.
I assume that's... Okay, Ms. Chair, if I could, one other question just on the bill itself. Where it says, any substance or object to another person with the intent that the other person use the substance. I mean, it's kind of like mind reading to a degree. I'm just wondering if that phraseology is a little bit sideways.
It's not. In any criminal charge, you have to show, the nexus with the minimal mens rea. And here it basically would be prohibitive if you are distributing or giving to someone something with the intent that they use that to carry out the suicide. As compared to if someone came to your garage and said, hey, can I get 6 feet of that hose that you have, the tubing, that in itself wouldn't get you there. But if someone came in and said, hey, I'm going to commit suicide, and you start providing them with the means to actually carry it out with the intent that they use that for that purpose, that would cover you.
Okay, I guess, Ms. Chair, and this may be the right language, I'm just kind of looking at, okay, you're going online to a site and you're ordering this thing. I could order it just because I want to see what it looks like. So I'm just wondering how you connect that the person selling it is intending for you to use it to commit suicide. Or am I overthinking this?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Cruz, if I may. There's no benign explanation for these things being sold together as a unit like this. It would be a stretch to suggest that they're selling 1,600 of these a year to people who are just curious about what one might look like. Somebody who's marketing these this way, and there are other methods of determining intent. For example, are they doing things in order to increase the hit count under suicide kit, which I suspect they probably are. They're probably investing in internet technology that will bring them to the top of the hit list when somebody searches for suicide kit. I think all of the circumstances collectively will make it very apparent that they're selling these to help people kill themselves.
Okay. I look for loopholes.
Yeah.
I mean, okay.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There were 4,870,000 hits, although not all of them. The second hit that comes up is the helium hood kits. And it does read information for terminally ill or hopelessly physically ill, competent adults, information on obtaining helium hood and party balloon kit. That's what it reads. The first hit.
Other questions or comments? Well, I do want to put on the records. I think part of the issues here that we have is that there's no check and balance from the chair's perspective. So anyone can actually go online. There's no way to determine whether or not that person is that minor, or if the person is, what their rational state of mind is. And that's one of the issues I think is very disturbing to myself, understanding that people make decisions in their lives. And the reality, though, I do believe that we as a state have an obligation when it comes to making certain that someone is in a rational mind and making these type of decisions, and most, and just as important, that it's someone of age that can actually make that decision on their own, not a minor. And that is one of the concerns I have. When I went up and looked at the sites, there's no way that you're going to be able to do that check and balance in maintaining those safeguards.
Chair Brzezinski, if I, and members of the committee, if I could say one more thing about Nick. One of the things that people don't understand is that when people die by suicide, that there's a sense of shame about that loss, and there's a sense of shame among people who felt that they might have been able to prevent it. In reality, a person such as Nick lived courageously, most probably with thoughts of suicide that any one of us would shatter anyone else. And he probably lived that way for a number of years and carried that inside himself and was ultimately unable to carry it anymore. So the idea that he would be remembered because of this fact, I would hope at some point people would understand the courage that those who are suicidal have when they walk through their lives day by day, living lives of quiet desperation, and most often looking as if they're well and happy and able to carry out on in jobs and in school. And at some point in time, a stressor will hit that they won't be able to carry. And so it's these kinds of opportunistic business ventures that would be detrimental to their health at times when they're at most risk. We don't want to see them.
All right. Thank you. Alex, one question regarding if we're going to elevate it. I assume if we went to a B, that would be sufficient.
Yes.
All right. Anything else?
Mr. Chair, I know that there's some people in the building today with compassion and care, or whatever it's called, the death of dignity folks. And I don't see this as being inconsistent with our death with dignity provisions, and I just wanted to put that on the record.
Yeah, and I personally don't either. It is in the sense of when you look at what the statutes provide for carrying out that act, it is different. But the reality, the safeguards that are within the act as making certain someone is rationally making a decision, competent to make that decision, is a key structure of our state statute. And this approach, to me again, seems to, let's say, leave those safeguards and other checks and balances to the side and is not something that we should be supporting. Other comments? All right, thank you very much for all coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 376-1? Not seeing him. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 376-1. And we'll come back. So what we're going to do regarding Senate Bill 376-1, we're now in the stage where we need to basically give notice that we will be carrying that bill forward. That bill will be carried over till tomorrow. I'm going to get clarification as to other bills that we have now for public hearing, if we can actually set a time certain for the work session. But at this point, we're carrying it over till tomorrow and make certain we get everything squared away. All right, with that, I've already closed the public hearing on 376. I'm going to go ahead and now open up our last public hearing for the day, which will be 963.
Chair, the committee cycle 963 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. I'm passing on the special board amendments that I got late Friday afternoon. Just getting some clarification. This bill relates to structured settlements. Clarifies the process and procedure as it relates to structured settlements. As chairman of the committee, you may see the advertisements and on TV from time to time, especially late at night, about structured settlements and people advertising to purchase them. We currently have a very detailed law as it relates to this, and this bill clarifies it. I understand from the drafter this is based on the California law, both the original bill and the amendments.
Okay. So I have four people that are currently, well, it looks like maybe five. So why don't we bring up Don Corson, Nolan Robinson, and Jack, I'm going to say Megan or Megan, I'm not sure how you, if it's a G in there. And gentlemen, whoever wants to get us started. Don.
Thank you, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Don Corson. I'm an attorney in private practice for Eugene. I've spent the last 25 years primarily representing injured individuals. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 963, which is needed to protect vulnerable Oregonians who must rely on structured settlements for their well-being and their future resources. A substantial amount of work typically goes into securing financial support for an injured individual. Often these cases take years. And sometimes these persons are elderly, or they're brain injured, or they are children. And in many of these cases, a structured settlement is arranged to help provide for the person's long-term needs. Often this is done under court supervision with court approval for the financial arrangements. Unfortunately, many of these people are easily taken advantage of. The planning and work that goes into protecting these people's future interests can later be undone by third parties who do not have the injured person's interests at heart. People who receive structured settlements rarely have the formal financial or economic training to be able to compare the relative value of certain future periodic payments to an offer of a lump sum payment. Many people who receive structured settlements are vulnerable in the sense of being subject to undue influence by people in their lives. And so these people must rely on structured settlements, and they deserve and need the protection of our legislature and our court system. I'd like to share with you one real-life example from my experience representing people. Let's call my client Mr. A to preserve his confidentiality. Mr. A suffered a traumatic brain injury when a large steel wrench was thrown or hurled through his skull into his brain. He suffered many cognitive losses, including loss of judgment. Physically, he was a triplegic. He lost partial function of both legs and one arm. Mr. A received some settlement funds without my involvement, and within a relatively short time, somewhere in the vicinity of $100,000 of his funds were lost because of the schemes and improper efforts of people around him. People in his life convinced him to buy them expensive gifts and to invest in a worthless real estate deal, all to their advantage and to his loss. We were able to secure some additional compensation for Mr. A. Most of those funds were placed in structured settlements that pay out a modest amount of money each month for the rest of his life. As long as the structured settlements are in place, A has money to live on, and he stays off of public assistance. And so as long as the structured settlement is in place, the amount of money that can be taken from him by unscrupulous people is very limited in a given month. If any of you stayed up late at night and watched late-night TV, you may have seen these advertisements. And these advertisements tell people like A that they can enjoy relative riches now if only they will give up these little structured settlement payments for what seems like a large amount of money, a lump sum. Sadly, the lump sum is usually steeply discounted and is only a fraction of the real value of those future periodic payments. So if we allow people to prey upon brain-injured people like Mr. A or other people, other Oregonians who are vulnerable, subject to undue influence, perhaps old or frail, we soon impoverish them and increase the burden on the Oregon taxpayers. There are unusual cases in which a structured settlement needs to be transferred. The existing law gives some guidance to the courts, but no detailed guidance about when those transfers should occur or under what circumstances. Senate Bill 963 provides reasonable safeguards and additional guidance to our courts to enable the interests of the vulnerable person to be protected at the same time to allow transfers when they are needed. If you have any questions, I'm more than delighted to try to answer them. I appreciate your willingness to listen to us and to consider this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nolan Robinson. I'm a structured settlement consultant with Ringler Associates, a national company with over 50 offices around the country.
Basically, what structured settlements are is a promise to make future payments, and those are funded typically through the purchase of an annuity from a life insurance company. So they're solid, they're secure, they're guaranteed, and there are certain tax benefits to doing it as well. So you can see that there are some benefits to those people who are beneficiaries of structured settlement payments. Regarding the factoring transactions of structured settlement payments, I have a number of thoughts, but mostly I see abuses in those situations. So I would support any kind of measure to strengthen the Structured Settlement Protection Act and to protect people who are receiving structured settlement payments. I did a quick survey, and by survey I called one factoring company and asked if I had $50,000 payment due to me in 5 years, what could you offer me? And he says, today I could offer you $21,000. It was just about $21,000. That's an example of the steep discount they're talking about. And as Mr. Corson mentioned, you know, typically these are payments that are designed for meeting future economic needs. It might be income, it might be medical needs, and without those payments, where are they going to turn to meet those needs? That's a big question. So the short-term benefit, if you want to call it that, sacrifices a much larger, greater future need. I also, don't know if it's been discussed, but a significant number of the structured settlements that I do right now are to fund what we call Medicare set-aside accounts. When people settle, or when Medicare beneficiaries settle a case involving future medical care, it is not Medicare's role to pay those future medical needs. So you set up an account wherein you pay yourself out of that account for Medicare-covered medical expenses. If people who are receiving those kinds of structured settlements factor those payments, obviously, again, you've got a situation where Medicare is taking on the burden that would otherwise be the role of the settlement proceeds. And that's just one example that may not have been discussed, but is a significant issue in the industry, because it is a big part of my business. So I assume that you can spread that out among the industry, and that's a big part of structured settlements. So the other issue that I am concerned about in terms of structured settlement factoring transactions is the education for the judges who hear those cases. While there is a law in place, I can honestly say I'm not convinced that the judges realize the power they have in reviewing each of those cases and being able to simply say no, that this is not in their best interest. Certainly there's cases where there's genuine hardship, and this is the only alternative for relieving that hardship. And in those cases, I'm happy that there is an outlet or vehicle for them to be able to take care of that. But by and large, I don't think that's the case, and I want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect, because we take seriously the role we have in protecting someone's financial future, and to see it undone is a hard thing to see. So thank you very much for your time, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
All right, great. Jack, would you go next?
Yes. Chairman Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Jack Milligan. I'm the president of Settlement Professionals, a Oregon corporation, nationwide settlement planning firm since 1987. Settlement planning utilizes structured settlements as a core strategy for these people. And you've already heard from the prior two speakers about structured settlements, so I won't repeat that here. But I came in support of the bill, 963. I'm also in support of factoring. Factoring is actually a good thing. It provides a safety valve for some of our clients who have life-changing experiences and need to change their circumstances. However, some of the factoring companies have been abusive in this regard, and they do need some some discipline. Most of our clients are unsophisticated, naive, and extremely vulnerable. We have experienced in many of our cases clients who should not be making decisions so close to their recovery from catastrophic injuries or extreme life-changing circumstances. And that is not my opinion. It's the opinion of the doctors who continue to treat these folks. Unfortunately, in many of our cases, these same people who should not be making decisions are not protected by the court system with a conservatorship. They're in a sort of a gray area. So it does fall, I believe, to the legislature to create some safeguards here in the form of a bill such as 963, which I helped write and craft. So this is necessary. It's good. It will not quash factoring. It will simply make it fair for these unfortunate people that have been involved in this circumstance and require that a court look at the circumstances and make sure that this is in the best interest of the individual and that their future income for support and medical expenses and support of their families and maybe support of their children is not disturbed in a way that would cause all of those parties to end up as wards of the state, in essence. I'll stop it there. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. I'm going to open up the panel and Senator Bonamici and Senator Whitson.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask if other states have passed similar provisions governing factoring.
It's my understanding they have. It's my I talked to one factoring company head this weekend about this legislation, and her comment to me was, in regard to the United States, Oregon is considered somewhat behind what some of the other states have done, and a little more regulation there would be a good thing.
And a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair?
You may.
So you said, Mr. Milligan, that you participated in drafting the legislation. Did you use any other state legislation as a model?
No, just reviewed this and made my comments.
Thank you.
And I do have one comment about this that I forgot to mention. There is a fee built into this legislation for independent review of one of these transactions and a report to be made to the court by an independent expert such as myself or Mr. Robinson. And the only thing I would caution there is, well, on the face of it, that's a good thing. That fee will be passed on to these people through these transactions. It will be. The factoring companies will lower the amount that they're going to offer to factor by that $1,500. So if there are any amendments to this bill in the future, I would caution the committee not to allow too many more fees to be allowed to on this because it's ultimately going to be paid by our injured clients.
All right. Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack, about how many cases of this factoring occur in Oregon each year?
I would estimate probably about 200.
It's my understanding that about 5%, isn't that the 5% of the cases that structure nationwide end up being factored. On the whole, the industry is about $6 billion in premium a year.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Chair, this probably would have a fiscal, and of course, sounds like a good bill, but it probably would have a significant fiscal.
I don't know why it would have a fiscal as to what agency do you think?
The courts.
I think the courts, they're already in litigation. We're going to hear from the opponents in a minute, but my understanding, most of this stuff is actually going into court now.
That's my understanding, members of the committee. If a transaction is to be factored now, there's an existing provision in the law to go before essentially a probate judge, but a judge, to review the transaction. But the problem, as I see it, is there's very little guidance given to the judge as to whether the transaction should be approved or denied or modified. And so what we're really doing is not adding to the burden of the court, but assisting our trial court judges by giving them guidance from the legislature about these transactions.
Thank you.
Right. And that's what I've heard, too, is that this basically would give a guidance as to how the court should look at these give them the quote-unquote tools to actually reject something outright. And I also understand, and I was going to ask Paul, but I'll go ahead and put the question out there. My understanding that if these factoring and transactions take place in court, it shelters, I guess, a cost of like 40% that is passed on. And I'm going to ask Mr. Cosgrove to go over this, because I've got word from another member that if you don't do it within court, there's extra fees that go into effect or something.
I can answer that, Chair.
Okay. Thanks.
Without court approval, the IRS code imposes a 40% excise penalty on one of these transactions to the factoring company. So they have they've got plenty of motivation to make sure they get court approval.
Right. Okay. That was it. Thank you for the clarification. Thank you for being my lifeline. All right.
I had Wikipedia for my lifeline. You explained that in order to avoid an excise tax penalty, all structured settlement factoring transactions must be approved by a state court in accordance with a qualified state statute.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Chairman, Commissioner, have you seen the Dash 1 amendments by any chance?
I have not. Okay. I apologize.
They showed up in my office late Friday afternoon, I think, if I may read them.
Sure.
On page 3, the printed bill after line 25, insert, if a transfer of payment rights is approved by the court or responsible administrative authority under RS 33865, the transferee may deduct the fee paid by the transferee under this section from the amount to be paid by the transferee to the payee.
And this is what Jack, I think, was talking about.
Okay.
So does anyone at the table claim the dash ones? All right.
Mystery.
Well, we're going to find out when we get to the back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Paul, you're up, and Earl Nisbet. Is there anyone else besides the two that are coming forward that will want to give testimony on 963? And Randy, is there anything else that we all need to cover?
I can actually answer the question.
Why don't you come on up and just sit up here and be part of the panel? Paul?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the National Association of Settlement Purchasers, and just right off the front, we don't claim the Dash 1 amendments either. I've not seen them, and we didn't order them.
Correct answer.
I was in this very room 6 years ago representing the NASP when Oregon passed the current statutes. They're now codified in ORS 33800, et cetera. And what we did is we adopted a model bill. And in contrast to what you just heard, the current Oregon law, the model bill, with slight variations, is the law, in fact, in 44 states. There are several states that don't have transfer statutes, but what we currently have in Oregon is the model. And I wanted to point out that that bill passed through this committee under a different chair at the time, and different members, for that matter, unanimously. And to the best of my recollection, unanimously or near unanimously through the entire body. And that was because it was worked out in advance. All the parties were at the table. Everybody looked at what the appropriate balance was to enable people who have changed circumstances to be able to get some or all of their structured settlement payments paid to them in advance of the time they would otherwise be paid, versus those people who are in need for future medical care who maybe it isn't appropriate. And I'd just like to point out that the current law right now gives pretty significant latitude to the court when it is approving these. And if you look at the bill on page 4, and if you look at the current law, which would be changed, but this particular provision maintained, the court has to make express findings under current law that the transfer is in the best interest of the payee, taking into account the welfare and support of all persons for whom the payee is legally obligated to provide support. That is the model law language, and it gives the court a good deal of latitude to address that issue. Mr. Nisbet is the executive director of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers, and he's going to review for you why we think that, in fact, many of the changes proposed in SEPA 963 are, frankly, in our view, anti-consumer. They will increase the cost of the transaction, make it more inconvenient for the people trying to apply to the court, and end up having an awful lot of very personal financial and medical information part of the public record, which we think is, in most cases, inappropriate. So, if I may turn it over to Mr. Nisbet, and of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Earl Nesbitt. I'm Executive Director of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. We are the companies that provide liquidity options to recipients of structured settlement payments, what I refer to as the secondary market. The gentleman behind me that spoke, or at least two of them, represent the primary market. They're the people who put people into structured settlements to settle lawsuits. And I'm certainly not here to criticize the primary market at all. That's an important part. And without the primary market, there would be no secondary market. But I think it's important to understand the difference. In the primary market is about, estimates are $5 to $6 billion per year market. Our market is about $400 million per year nationwide. What that works out to is about 6 to 7, maybe 8% of people who get a structured settlement at some point in their lives will take advantage of a secondary market transaction. The other thing to understand is that the vast majority, I'd say over 95% of secondary market transactions, do not involve a person selling all of their future structured settlement payments. What it involves is someone who has lost a job, who has a medical problem, who has a foreclosure or a bankruptcy, and who needs to access a portion of their future payments. They may sell half of their monthly payment for 5 years. And that's the transaction that's presented to the court. So even though 6 to 7, maybe 8% of the people take advantage of this, they're not selling all of their payments. They're not being left without their payment stream at all. What's also important to understand is when someone enters into a structured settlement, a few times, yes, that might be subject to court approval if it involves a minor or an incompetent. But the vast majority of structured settlements are entered into voluntarily by adults, sometimes, quite often with the assistance of counsel, but sometimes without a counsel, and it's not subject to court approval. There is no disclosures provided to primary market transactions about what the value of the annuity is. There are no front-end disclosures. On the secondary market, when they're selling payments for a discounted present value, there are disclosures, and in every transaction in the state of Oregon and in 46 other states, it must be court approved. The statute that's on the books in Oregon right now is a model statute that exists almost word for word in 36 other states, very, very similar in about 10 additional states, and then there's one state, California, that is completely different, and there's a reason for that, and the reason it starts out with when California first enacted the statute, there was no court approval requirement. The bottom line is what this statute does is change that model act. We're concerned about what that will do because of the interrelationship with the federal transfer statute, which, by the way, our trade association supported court approval in every transaction. We're not afraid of court approval. We think it's necessary and appropriate. We supported the excise tax provision. We supported in Oregon with Mr. Cosgrove here. So we do support court approval, but we think it's important to understand that payees who enter into structured settlements with the gentleman behind me are not always and very often are not advised that if they ever want liquidity, they have to go to court. They have to disclose a lot of personal information to the court in open court, in pleadings filed with the court, and that they don't have sort of the free alienability of their property rights. They don't know that when they go into. The first time they understand that is when they contact our member companies. We tell them, you got to go to court. A lot of times they say, hey, I don't want to do that. You know, I don't need it this bad, or I'll find another way. But often they do. What the amendments do is require the disclosure of personal income information, not only of the person seeking to transfer their payments, but also of their spouse and their family. It requires them to discuss what medical care that they have or may anticipate in the future. It requires them to discuss their income, their financial resources, and all that must be disclosed in the pleadings filed in court. Now, I will tell you that as a practical matter, the judges in Oregon do a very good job, my understanding, I don't practice here, of making that inquiry if they feel they need to. For instance, lots of times the people we're doing transactions with are attorneys who have structured settlement payments as part of their settlement. Or they may be a banker or a financial advisor or someone who has entered into a transaction. Not all the time, but there are people who do that. the judges who review that usually feel, you know, I don't need to give this transaction quite as much scrutiny because this person is sophisticated or they have the advice of counsel. Other times when someone comes in and doesn't have that advantage, then the judge does inquire more into their financial resources and the reasons for doing it. They always ask, why are you doing this? Do you understand you're giving up? Every person gets a disclosure. Every person has court approval. We feel that the current statute works better and works well for the 120 to 150 Oregonians, and I hope that's the right way you describe people from Oregon, who take advantage of this. Jack estimated 200. I'd say it's a little less than that based on the statistics I have. 120 to 150 Oregonians per year go into court and try to do a partial transfer of structured settlement payments. We believe that the amendments are very, very intrusive. They make the cost higher. Okay, they delay the transaction. Right now, from start to finish, a transaction minimum is going to be 60 days. If this is going to at least double that in our estimation, because you have to give a 30-day notice in addition to the 10-day notice, in addition to the 20-day notice. The 30-day notice is added by this relative to the council. We certainly support court approval. We certainly support judges getting all the information they want. Judges do deny these. They don't do it a lot because it's not in our interest to bring transactions before them that they're going to be denied. And the other thing I would caution you is that if you make the transactions in Oregon even more intrusive and more difficult, I'm afraid that there are unscrupulous players out there, and there are. There's a company in Texas that's not a member of my trade association. I hate to say it's in Texas because that's where I'm from. They're not a member of our trade association, and they tried to get around the court approval by taking people to arbitration. We had to sue them in federal court, along with some insurance companies that on the primary market, and we were able to get that. But there are unscrupulous players out there, and if you make this transactions too hard, the people who say, I don't want to go into court with a stranger and disclose my income, my husband's income, my medical condition, my children's names and addresses, all that in writing, I'm afraid what we're going to have is people running to unscrupulous players and going out of Oregon to get these transfers done, maybe in the state where the annuity company is, or the state where the case was settled, if it wasn't settled in Oregon. So I don't want to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater here. We certainly understand no one's advocating any change to this where people can get these things done willy-nilly without court approval. They're advised currently. They must be advised in writing that they have the right to independent professional advice. They must either receive that advice or waive the opportunity to receive that advice in writing. They're given a disclosure 10 days before they sign an agreement. It sets forth what they're selling, what they're receiving, and sets forth that they have a right of rescission, sets forth the admonition regarding counsel. This is a very protective statute. We support it. We think it's a good statute. We think it works. And I think if we go down this road of amending it, and this follows on, I know Jack said he didn't think this follows any other state, but it does. It follows some changes made in California a couple years ago, and we have found that the cost and the delay are much higher in California, and it really hasn't added a lot to the judge's consideration because all the factors that are listed here are things that judges consider on a case-by-case basis. Again, if they feel it's necessary, they pay particular attention to a transaction involving a 19-year-old kid who just turned old enough to make this decision versus a 50-year-old man like myself who may have some financial training. And that makes perfect sense. I tell all my clients, if you're going to send me a 19-year-old kid, you better have a very good reason for it and a very good transaction because the judges are going to give that scrutiny. And we think the place, the place that this the rubber hits the road, if you will, is within court review and court approval and letting the judges determine based on the person who's standing in front of them and the nature of the transaction before them how best to address it. I thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Randy, do you have any comments that you want to make, or are you just here to answer questions?
I'm just here to answer questions. I would say with the...
put your name on the record.
Oh, sorry, Randy Derrick. I am legislative staff for Representative Paul Holby. And I will first of all claim the -1 amendments. We thought that that we had claimed those earlier, but we will claim those. And the intent of those was, as earlier they said that they would take the $1,500 and take it all out. The intent of those amendments was that if there were any accrued costs, say $840, that it would be those costs that would be taken out of the costs, and that would be taken out of the cost of the final transfer. So it was just kind of a clearing up of a possible ambiguity that we had seen in there.
All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? Earl, what part of Texas?
Dallas.
All right. That's where my wife's from.
I understand you're, I hate to say this, an Aggie?
I'm on the correct side. The okay. University. The first one in the state.
Well, I have friends who are Aggies, but I went to UT. I'm sorry.
I have friends that went to UT. We're still friends.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, because I know that there's something special about being a Texan, I made sure that my client knew what part of Texas, and in particular that you were an Aggie.
Well, all I was going to say was it was nice to have someone here that didn't have an accent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
All righty. There's no one else that wants to give testimony on the Senate Bill 963. I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. What I do need to do before we close for today, regarding all three bills that we had, I'm carrying them over till tomorrow. That's my understanding, my instructions. I'm going to make certain that this is how we'll be proceeding for the next 2 weeks, or whether we can set a date certain for a possible work session in the future. But at this point, Senate Bills 376, Senate Bill 961, and Senate Bill 963 are carried over till tomorrow. And then the last thing, committee, as we've stated, this is our last 2 weeks, as all of us know, before our bills have to get out of the chamber or out of the committee to go to the floor. What I anticipate is next week we will be meeting at least at 8 o'clock in the morning. There is a possibility, depending on where we're at, we may need to meet at 7:30 instead of going later. But keep in mind, on Thursday the 21st, I do ask that you leave open your afternoon or your evening at 5:15.
On the 21st.
The reason for that is if we have fiscals that have not come back in the morning, they will more than likely be able to make them back before the end of the day. And if we have a bill that we want to move out, I want to make certain we have a quorum here to do that. So on Thursday the 21st, please note in your records and please ask your staff to have you available from 5:15, knowing that Senator Dingfelder and I will be in committee Environment Natural Resource till 5 or maybe a little bit later, depending on how her schedule is. And so at this point, we will be here tomorrow at 8:30. I will make a determination today with judiciary staff whether we need to be meeting earlier than 8:30 the rest of this week. If we do, yes.
Chair, Thursday.
Thursday. Okay, Thursday, let's plan on meeting at 8, and I will make a determination by this evening whether we need to move up to 7:30. But at this point, we'll say 8 o'clock for this Thursday. Tomorrow will be 8:30 as well as Wednesday. Any other comments?
8 o'clock on Thursday. 8
o'clock on Thursday the 14th. All right, with that, we'll see everyone here tomorrow at 8:30.